You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, former New York State Senator Daniel Squadron, co-founder and executive director of the States Project. On the key states that are in play and will have implications on the Moore v. Harper case. Also on the program today, Amanda Bach, museum curator and shop steward of the Philadelphia Museum of Art Union, which just won their 19-day strike in Philadelphia. Also on the program today, Durham's almost four-year investigation of the investigators scores another failure, and perhaps its final failure. Meanwhile, Donald Trump scheduled to testify. They're taking a deposition of him in his defamation suit on that woman who accused him of rape. As the Republicans back off abortion bans, the generic ballot seems to shift towards the GOP. Democrats now sounding alarms. Polls show Masters closing on Kelly, Oz closing on Fetterman. Meanwhile, bad news up near Albany, New York. Amazon labor union loses an election at a warehouse just outside of Albany. Strikes spread across France over welfare cuts and cost of living increases. Meanwhile, in this country, Biden releasing oil reserves, trying to keep gas prices down in anticipation of the election 3 weeks from now. New Jersey Attorney General to sue oil companies over climate change. And there's an Idaho bill now that would prohibit drag performances. Yes. Putin introduces martial law in occupied Ukraine, shutting down on things like dissent, reporting,
labor strikes,
you know.
Fight fascism.
Fight, exactly. That'll show those Nazis. Meanwhile, Republican plans Social Security and Medicare cuts if they get into the majority. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it. Emma is out today. She's feeling a little bit under the weather, but give her a little chance to rest up. It's going around. There's a cold going around. I think people can still hear it. And believe me, the amount of testing that goes on in my house between my daughter and I, and occasionally checking my son. But Mile and I both had colds. She, of course, got over it in about 4 days. And it lasts with me for about 6 months, probably. That's the way it works. Thanks for joining us, folks. Let's start with this. We are now, some amount of time from the election. People can do their own math. It's November 8th, right, is the Tuesday of the election. We'll be doing live coverage that night. What we're going to be doing exactly, I don't know. But also, if you're in LA, don't forget to check out, what are you calling this? This is like a super group thing.
Yeah, it's a.
It's like the traveling Wilburys.
Give them a revolution. I think is the phrase. But Ben Burgess, This Is Revolution. Jason Miles, Left Reckoning with me and David Griscom, Derek Varn, Anna Kasparian. We got a lot of people.
Why couldn't it have been Give Them a Reckoning with the Revolution?
Because I think Jason and Ben Burgess were the point guys on this, so they're sort of hosting the evening.
So
David and I are just sort of like, you know, the kickers they throw in.
Wow. It's like, honestly, it's like a super group.
Yeah. It's like, what's the one Jimmy Page was in? The Yardbirds?
Yes.
Yeah. There you go. So,
Derek and the Dominoes.
Where can people get more information on that, Matt?
We will put the link into, the tickets are at Ticketmaster. We'll put the link in the show description today.
Okay. So folks should check that out. And I want to say in advance, since we already have one person commenting on my shirt, thank you. For the compliment on my shirt. I wasn't sure if this would moray, and it turns out it didn't, and we did the test up front, and I was like, okay, I can expand my shirt portfolio. Exciting stuff here. Let's go right to a debate that's taking place in Minnesota. You know, we just spent the other day talking about Minnesota nice, and I guess this was a nice way for Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota to remind Minnesotans that the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Dr. Scott Jensen, was, I don't know, is it fair to call him a pill mill?
Yes, I think in the top 94 percentile, as Walz points out, in the state.
Well, that's pretty up there.
Yeah. I'd be happy about that if that was my
but it's
ACT
not like.
Tests.
But it's not exactly. But it's not like, you know, he was dispensing these pills because he was like being wined and dined by pharmaceutical Well, let's tune into this.
IC News Now.
Many of our viewers have reached out about the ongoing opioid crisis affecting communities big and small. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, nearly 1,300 people in this state died last year from an overdose. That is up 20% from 2020. Now rainbow fentanyl pills, looking like candy, have reached Minnesota. Authorities first finding the brightly colored fentanyl, which could appeal to kids, in Mankato last month. As governor, what specifically would you do to address this ongoing crisis and save lives? The question going to Governor Walz first.
Yeah, the opioid crisis, and it continued to accelerate. We've seen this in Minnesota. It's even disproportionately hits our communities of color, especially our indigenous communities. Certainly the idea of stopping them at the border, but there's a lot of things that we can do on the front end, making sure that we're stopping that demand, making sure that we have the current services available. I want to say one thing I'm really proud of in Minnesota. Minnesota was one of the states that sued the manufacturers who were making this. This opioid pandemic started, and some of you have seen the shows, you've seen the documentaries that have been done on this, that they started pushing these things for profit and ended up spreading into our communities. That's where most of this has come from. And I have to say, I want to be very clear about this. They didn't do it alone. When Scott was issuing opioid prescriptions, he issued more than 94% of his peers. He did that at the same time while accepting meals from the manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies, wining and dining on expensive meals. And then he did an expose that was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that was entitled Confessions of a Prescription Drug Pusher, where Scott acknowledged that their impact on him and marketing impacted his prescribing of those. It's getting at the front end of this. It's understanding why it got it out there. It's doing what the state of Minnesota did, suing and then putting in processes to both capture the opioids before they get there and working with folks who are in recovery. Minnesota can do that.
Thank you, Governor Walz. Dr. Jensen, you have 90 seconds.
Without question, the fentanyl that plagues us today is taking a tremendous number of lives. I think over 100,000 drug overdose deaths in 2021, and two-thirds of those were fentanyl. In the 1980s and the 1990s, there was absolutely a heavy-duty pharma push to encourage physicians to use more narcotics and opiates. We actually had another vital sign, which was the pain management level. What's your pain level, 1 through 10? And if we didn't ask that, we weren't, quote, doing good medicine. So I don't disagree with Tim Walz. Physicians and the healthcare system have contributed to the problems. And in terms of going out to dinner and having an educational event, yeah, that could happen as well.
Yeah.
But I think the important thing is,
you know, I think Walz did a good job here, but you got to sort of close the loop. If this guy is out there, more than 94% of his peers, being swayed by a couple of educational, so-called educational events, you know, junkets that maybe just took place in the Caribbean, or just some nice dinners and maybe a couple of pens and a little tchotchkes. This is not exactly the guy you want in charge of the entire, you know, budget of the state of Minnesota.
Yeah.
The guy is basically saying, more than 94% of my peers, I am really open to being lobbied. And either it takes very little, you know, a nice dinner, or, you know, just an educational pitch. And I will not only be open to lobbying, but to being convinced that these opioids are special opioids that are not addictive. And I would also, you know, I didn't read that piece then where he was sort of the you know, it's confessional. But at one point, you know, like at one point, do you not realize this is going on? Because at one point, maybe you do. And you just, you know, they're being nice to me over at the place. I mean, these guys are nice guys.
Yeah. And after the part we cut, he goes on to say, yeah, we need to stop the stuff at the border, which is just wild to see somebody who is prescribing this stuff over his peers to say, yeah, it's coming across the border.
I mean, at this point, it may be coming across the border, but it's coming across the border to satiate an addiction that was started in his office.
Right.
Those opioid stories get me really upset. I mean, you know, I just got back from Vegas from those tort lawyers, and those guys did a lot of this. And they, you know, some hit the corporations that manufactured it, some hit the PBMs that basically distributed it to the pill mills. It really is extraordinary the amount of damage that created in this country. I mean, we don't have time to go into like some broad. Omnibus problem, but I'm not convinced that part of the difficulty we had in terms of public health in dealing with COVID wasn't in some part a function of what we had just gone through, where our public health system essentially, not public, but our health system essentially created a massive bump in the death rate amongst Americans. Like actuarially, our life expectancy went down in this country for, I think, particularly white males, because you had doctors and pharmacies handing out this stuff. And that almost sounds too benign, but really horrific damage across the board. All right, we're going to get to Daniel Squadron in just a moment. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Stage Project. Obviously, a lot of state houses in play coming up in the fall, and that's it. Well, fall. I mean, we're here 3 weeks out. But first, a word from our sponsor. I love these guys. IAC Laser Engraving. They're a leftist-owned worker collective started by a longtime listener, Ryan Lubin, in September of 2021. His company's democratically structured. They ensure any hierarchies are completely justified and efficient. They use sustainably sourced materials coupled with extremely energy-efficient laser technology to bring you really cool products and gifts you're not going to find anywhere else. Your purchase of their items not only gets you one-of-a-kind product, it goes directly to supporting a business model that is structured around compassionate and worker-centered care, as opposed to the more ubiquitous and predatory authoritarian ones found throughout capitalism. All right, so first off, check out this photo frame. Folks know that I am a little bit of a woodworking hobbyist. The stuff that these guys are able to do with their lasers is just, it blows me away. this is a photo frame, and has its own stand. They bend the, I guess that's like, I don't even think that's quarter inch wood, but the way that they bend it is by creating all of these ridges in it, and it bends there. You know, you get your plastic, protects the picture. It's a beautiful photo frame. It's just one example of it, of the work they do. This has acrylic glass, like I say. It's 10 times stronger than regular glass, so it's not going to break when your kid knocks it over with his play sword. Just coincidentally, you know, possibly.
Stop some soup, too.
Exactly. Stop some soup. This piece is available for $85 at lasers.com. Comes in four different hand-stained varieties, or you can customize it for a unique look. Look, that's one of the things that these guys do really, really well, is customize stuff. I'll get to that in a moment, because I want to show you this, which is going up on Saul's Saul's room as soon as we're done promoting IAC.
That's trippy to look at even in real life.
Yeah, it's totally nuts. And you can see it's actually like a bunch of different... I mean, I've seen stuff like this on a bigger scale with like big pieces of plywood, but because of their laser, they can cut into like multiple different forms. This is an astronaut. It's got eight layers of hand-painted, hand-glued basswood and eucalyptus. Comes with a stand for support, or you can obviously, you can easily imagine hanging it on the wall. This item goes for $75. You can check it out at iaclasers.com. In addition to the astronaut piece, they have over 60 other 3D layered mandalas, animals, mythical creatures. Custom options are also available. And this is the thing that's awesome about IAC. They can customize a lot of stuff. Particularly, they have these amazing wood puzzles. We have one over there. But each puzzle is made, like with all their stuff, with a sustainable wood, in this case, eucalyptus. They use high-definition UV printer to render each image onto wood, and then it's cut into the desired amount of pieces. There are over 30 different puzzle images to choose from. You got images and paintings from local Ohio leftist artists in a variety of different puzzle ranges from 99 to 500 plus. Each puzzle comes in its own nice felt-lined box. It's designed by them. There's a latch. It really is beautiful. But here's the thing. You can also get custom family or personal photos that can be made into wooden puzzles for an additional fee. So this makes a great, like, grandparent, parent, cousin, gift, maybe with a baby. I don't know. There's so many. Visit iaclasers.com. Order yours today. Enter in the coupon code MAJORITY10 at purchase. You'll get a 10% discount on their amazing products. That is MAJORITY10 at iaclasers.com. Go ahead and check that out. We will put, of course, as we always do, the link in the podcast and YouTube description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to former New York State Senator Daniel Squadron, co-founder and executive director of the States Project. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program former New York State Senator Daniel Squadron, co-founder and executive director of the States Project. Daniel, welcome to the program. We were just talking before we came on air that I think, I don't know if I exactly met you, But I think I was first introduced to you when you were a state senator. It must have been late 2016, early 2017, in the basement of a yoga studio. There were many, many groups organizing around the city like this, both in Brooklyn and Manhattan. I attended functions where people were organizing around the idea of how can we start to impact states around the country. This is before you co-founded the States Project. And so it's good to see you again. And that was a good presentation, incidentally.
Oh, thank you very much. Now all over the country. So a lot has changed since then, except for the basic argument, which is state legislatures are the source of the biggest risks and biggest positive change that the country's seen over the last decades.
I also have had this theory that in 2018, where we saw record-breaking numbers of Democrats come out to vote, that a lot of, and not all of that, obviously there was a lot of other things, but that a significant portion of that turnout was a function of people working more on grassroots and state races, and sort of almost there being a reverse coattail effect on some level. Because, I mean, if you turn out, if you've got money as a state rep or a state senator and you're turning out people to the polls, you have a closer connection, obviously, because you have a smaller constituency, and you're driving turnout, it seems to me.
You know what you're really driving as well is a sense, you know, these sort of partisan caricatures definitely take hold. We're aware of that. And because you have individual relationships with the voters in your district, or you do if you're good at this and you're out campaigning, knocking on doors, doing the things we hope folks do, then what you can actually do is sort of help folks know that, like, these caricatures aren't really true. And that, I think, changes the tone and the tenor. You know, look, the truth is that for someone at the bottom of the ballot to change turnout in significant ways can be really difficult. But we know that the bottom of the ballot both is most likely to just kind of get caught up in that partisan caricature and has the most capacity to break out of it, because you can meet a critical mass of the voters.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about Moore v. Harper, right? I mean, you guys generally, well, I mean, I imagine you pay attention to Supreme Court cases, but this one is right in your wheelhouse as you start to, you know, in an attempt to sort of claw our way back from 2010, which was a devastating year for Democratic control of state houses and state governments. Give us a breakdown of what Moore v. Harper is. This is a case that is at the Supreme Court. I don't know that they've had oral arguments yet.
December 7th.
That's coming up in a month or two. And it will be decided by June of next year. But so break this case down for us.
So the basic idea is it has to do with a fight over the districts, the gerrymandering, the map drawing in North Carolina, in which a court said that it was vastly too partisan, had any number of other problems. And so the state lawmakers who drew the maps, note, also drew the maps for themselves, choosing their own voters. The Republican leadership sued and said the court shouldn't have any oversight over our maps.
And this is the state, we should say this is the North Carolina State Supreme Court.
North Carolina State Supreme Court said these maps are overly partisan, they're unfair, the Republican legislature went way too far here. Republican lawmakers there and leadership said, you know what, we don't think the court should have any say in map drawing, because we believe in a absolutely, they didn't use these terms, but they might as well have, absolutely absurd legal theory called the independent state legislature doctrine, which in short says when it comes to federal elections, the state legislature has all the power. By the way, not the state government, but the state legislature, state courts, governors, the departments and agencies, they're out of this. It's only the legislatures. It's a wild idea. So such a wild idea that you'd hope the Supreme Court didn't take it up, but they
have.
Well,
no, we should say one of the things that makes it a really wild idea is that we have a U.S. Constitution that is pretty explicit as to who has, you know, sort of like ultimate authority, I guess, over federal elections. This is, and we should be clear, we're not talking about state elections here. We're talking about congressional districts.
That's right. Congressional districts, and there's a real risk here to presidential electors as well. In fact, right, the irony here could well be that state courts, governors are kicked out of a role in federal elections, even while they maintain one in state elections. It is through the looking glass stuff. But, you know, through the looking glass and having no chance to the Supreme Court are no longer synonymous. We know that three members of the court have signaled a real openness to this. A fourth member, so Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas signaled real openness to this. Kavanaugh has danced with it as well. But don't worry, Amy Coney Barrett has said nothing about this Federalist Society-backed doctrine, so I'm sure she'll stand up to the Federalist Society and the other far-right-wing judicial efforts and protect us from this absurd new constitutional right for state legislatures.
Oh, wow. Now I feel like I can breathe easy, knowing that Amy Coney Barrett is there as the voice of reason. So, okay, so obviously, there's not much you can do as the state's project in terms of dealing with the outcome of that case. But what can we do to mitigate the impact of that case, which also happens to align with your project anyways?
Right. And let me just say, I haven't even talked about the scariest possible outcome of that case, which is the idea that when it comes to presidential electors, state legislatures, again, not governors, not secretaries of state, not state courts, state legislatures will have a unique authority to determine the winner of the state's presidential electors. So the reason that's particularly scary is today, every swing state in America, every presidential swing state in America has a unified Republican legislature. They have states adding up to nearly 310 presidential electors. So if they have ultimate authority deciding who won, if they're handed that by the Supreme Court, it is tantamount to pre-deciding the presidential election or handing the presidential election to a bunch of state lawmakers. By the way, a majority of those majorities have in one way or the other signaled their support for the big lie.
I just want to just reiterate, just, you know, before we move into like the specific states that we're talking about, how sort of bat-crap crazy this is. The idea that we're not even talking about the state having the authority, that like the state government having the authority. We're talking about one element within the state government. We have three branches of our governments in this country: judicial, legislative, and executive. And they're just deciding that it's just going to be the legislative has unique authority over drawing the congressional maps or sending the electors, but not over necessarily unique authority over even making the state Senate maps. It's just nobody would have consciously designed anything like that. And it seems like if it was just a mistake, someone would have picked up on it over the past, 200 years, because there's been multiple cases just even in the past decade at the Supreme Court level that has basically already shown that this theory is bunk.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the idea that this constitution somehow reaches into states, overrides their constitution, and provides this unique type of power to one branch of government in a constitution designed around the balance of powers is, I mean, it's comical. But as we know, you know, the absurd and the tragic, as you know, you're trying to destroy a democracy, get very close to each other. And one becomes the other here very quickly. So here's the thing that's particularly upsetting. If you just do the electoral map math, the only way to have a free and fair presidential election is to have more than 270 presidential electors that, you know, follow the popular will in their state. To get there, you need to get them from 310 to under 270. Michigan and Arizona are the best chances to do that this year. And if we don't do that this year, we will not have a chance to do it before presidential electors get sent to Congress, because whoever wins in, what is it now? Every day is rolling in. It might be 100 hours. It might be 2.5 weeks.
Right.
If from the election, whoever's elected November 8th, in Arizona and Michigan will continue to serve in those state legislatures, in those majorities, until January 1st of 2025. That means that if you have unified Republican control in the Arizona legislature, as you do today, unified Republican control in the Michigan legislature, as you do today, a majority of members of both of those majorities having said they don't think Joe Biden was elected in 2020, it seems very difficult for those presidential electors to go to the legitimate winner rather than the predetermined winner on their part. And this is all over November 8th in terms of those elections.
I see. Okay. So, I mean, this is the way you know, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules on this, this is a basically way of short circuiting based upon what we know will more than likely be the swing votes, the swing states in 2024. So we're talking Arizona, Michigan, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania are the four states that you're focusing on. Is that right?
So Arizona and Michigan are absolutely in that very unique category. Nebraska is sort of a fun one in the middle. The only unicameral legislature in America, as I'm sure you and all of your viewers are intimately familiar with.
Of course.
Nebraska is actually a place where there's sort of a supermajority threshold that's at issue that could potentially protect a single presidential elector, depending how the second congressional district in Nebraska goes. Then Pennsylvania and New Hampshire actually are in sort of their own special place. And by the way, I don't know how many hours I'm booked here for, but we're going to go deep. Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, whoever's elected in 2024 to the state legislatures will take office before electors get sent to Congress. So you get sort of two bites at the apple, but it all matters because you're setting the stage for 24. So Arizona and Michigan, clock is ticking. Whoever's elected November 8th, they're going to be the ones in power. They're going to be the ones deciding whether to undermine the entire presidential election. Nebraska, kind of an interesting case that's been largely overlooked nationally. Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, very important this year. And November 9th, we have to keep working. And I just want to underline this because, I know folks on the right also listen to your show and other things. We're just trying here to create legislatures that stay out of it.
Right.
We're not trying to flip the legislature. So just trying to create legislatures that are split so they can't come together and override the will of their voters. We're trying to protect the majority vote in these states by keeping the legislature from overriding it. And it's just a really important thing to emphasize.
Okay. So in Arizona, one seat in either one of the chambers would prevent the level of control by conservatives in those legislatures that would allow them to essentially flip whatever the results of the election were in terms of the way people voted. So and so have you guys, I imagine you guys have isolated the best, what, three chances for that in each house, or is that, two? I don't know. How does that work? Because yeah, so, I should also just say, in Michigan, you have a similar dynamic. Three more seats in the Senate or two in the House would have the same impact. So Arizona is just one in either house. In Michigan, it's three in one and two in the other. And this seems like a good year for Michigan because Whitmer is really, I think, it feels like there is a, she has a she's been running a strong campaign, and it appears like the Michigan is not as out of reach as three or two sounds maybe in a less favorable environment.
Yeah, that's right. And in Michigan, you also have fairer maps. They actually drew legislative maps fairly for the first time, which makes it even more competitive. And it's 2-3 seats in the U.S. Senate or even a congressional context sounds daunting. In a state legislative context, 2-3 seats could be in total, something like 1,500 voters' decisions,
right,
across three districts that end up being the difference. And so, but it's also as you cover a whole lot, it is a political environment that is unknown. Certainly, a political environment that appears quite unlikely to be more favorable than 2020.
Right.
And so to outperform 2020, even with everything you say about Governor Whitmer's strength, which is really what they're seeing on the ground in these districts as well, even with fairer maps, even with more attention, is a tough road. So, in Arizona, there are three or four that are the most competitive seats, especially in the Senate. A similar number in the Michigan Senate. But, you know, an interesting thing in both of those chambers, and this certainly isn't the goal, but if we're being realistic about the environment, you know, they say sometimes that close isn't good enough, except in, is it horseshoes and hand grenades? In the case of these chambers, it is certainly not the goal. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. Do you know that a very small number, less than 10%, of Republican lawmakers in the Michigan legislature have suggested that Joe Biden, ready for this, is a legitimately elected president? Fewer than 10%. But what that means is how close we are in these chambers, even in a tough year, will make a real difference. Because when you're one seat away, you only need half as many Republicans to do the right thing, even if they're committing suicide within their party, than if they're two seats away. Two seats is a third better than three seats. And so each seat in each of these chambers could well matter, because at some point, when you're talking about a free and fair presidential election, we need to hope that folks will move beyond party and decide which side of the democracy they're on.
I would imagine, too, that if I get elected with a 10-vote margin as opposed to a 1,500-vote margin, I'm going to be a little bit less inclined, maybe your average person, to just go with what my colleagues are saying. If I think that, like, hey, you know, Biden may have won in my district, or something to that effect. So every little bit helps. All right. So how can folks help your project here in targeting these seats?
So statesproject.org, you can go to. I know that you have featured GiveSmart here before. The GiveSmart program, which is a super targeted way to move money directly to campaigns that need it the most, based on our internal analysis, is up and running at statesproject.org. There's also giving circles. These are groups of givers like the ones that we started with in that basement. Again, now all around the country, focusing on states, and so. Those two things. And then I really have to emphasize the third. The pressure here to focus on the big personalities and the big press coverage of statewide candidates, the campaign for Congress, I get it. Those are important things. But go to the website and just read about it. Go to the web, like, bring it up at dinner. Because for the presidential election, there is not going to be a more consequential race this year than the closest race in the Arizona Senate. Or the Michigan Senate. And, you know, very few people think about that or know that, for good reason. It's an absurd idea. It just happens to be one that's likely to end up true.
Daniel Squadron, real pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll put links to all that in our podcast and YouTube description. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks. See you in a basement.
All right. Yeah, I'll see you then. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Amanda Bach. She's a museum curator and shop steward, the Philadelphia Museum Art Union. They have just won their strike. And we can now all go see the Matisse exhibit without feeling like we're a scab. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Amanda Bach. She is the museum curator and shop steward, the Philadelphia Museum of Art Union. Amanda, welcome to the program, and I guess I should say congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm calling in from my office, where I've returned after 3 weeks on a picket line.
So, all right. So let's back up. You guys were on strike for 19 days. I know you had been working on this contract for it seems like at least a year, right? But before we get that, What you guys are AFSCME, that is the public sector union. Who is the boss? Who owns the Philadelphia Museum? Who have you been in negotiations with, and how long is the union? How long have you guys been unionized?
Yeah, so we are actually a private sector museum, and we started talking about forming a union here in 2019. So that's about 3 years ago now today, and our union is the first what we call a wall-to-wall union for a major museum in the United States. So we, when we formed our union, it was staff from across every department in the museum, from curatorial, like myself, conservation, development, visitor services, retail. So a wide swath of jobs that make a museum run. And we filed for an election during COVID, and we won with 89% voting yes for a union in August of 2020.
Oh, that's great. And talk to me about that decision of being wall to wall, because you've got a broad mix of people. I imagine, you know, if you're going to be a curator, you have studied art history and studied art, but you're not necessarily maybe having those degrees if you're working in operations or in other parts of the museum. What was behind that decision at the time?
I think talking to our colleagues across the institution, our jobs are very different in scope and responsibility, but we shared a lot of the same concerns about how museums run, the decisions that are made that impact our lives. A big one on the list, unsurprisingly, is salary. So we started talking across museums. There was a spreadsheet that started circulating in 2019 where people would anonymously report what their salaries were and benefits at multiple cultural institutions across the country. And we found lots of discrepancies, both between what we make and our peers in other museums in Philadelphia or New York or Chicago make, but even amongst our own staff, so people doing the same job with the same qualifications and responsibilities, making upwards of thousands of dollars difference in salary a year. We all share the same health insurance plan across departments and found lots of woes and inadequacies in healthcare access, as well as a cost that felt out of reach to most people in our union. So there were driving forces that people in all departments could agree on would make this a better workplace for everybody.
It's interesting too that you guys started this movement in 2019. So this is before COVID, and which I imagine the museum was shut down for a period of time over that period. Was talk about? I'd like to know how many people are in the union, but I imagine that's a very hard time to organize because, even in this office, we're all here together, but I would imagine with disparate things, you don't necessarily have all have social connections that, you see each other at the museum, maybe you see each other at the commissary. There's literally a commissary there, I would imagine. And it's easier to organize, but you did a lot of the organizing when you guys were not at work.
Yeah, I think we had started signing authorization cards just before COVID hit. So we were fairly well organized. I think a challenge was the instability that became very clear in all of our work during COVID. The museum shut down at two different points from March to September 2020 and again in the winter of 2020 into early 2021. There were mass layoffs in the summer of 2020 and a lot of retirement buyout programs for people who may not have otherwise left their jobs. So, a big hit for us was certainly just losing a lot of people who were involved in organizing our union, who were, dedicated colleagues. There was a lot of fracturing in our community during COVID for sure. But I think that also the people who were still here really reinforced the need for things like protections, for layoffs, for job security, because, you know, we all wanted to still work here.
Right.
But the circumstances were challenging for sure.
And I should say, I mean, just the limited exposure I've had with museum workers, just because my daughter had a summer job, was that regardless of what capacity at the museum someone's working, they all like have, I think, a greater attachment to the institution than you normally see with across the spectrum of people working at a place.
Yeah, and I think that was a major incentive for us in forming a union, was that very love of the museum and the work that we do here being really at odds with the ways that this job can and this work can be very untenable, both financially, both in terms of stability and precarity of the kind of work that we do. And I think that in unionizing, we've actually done a favor to a museum. We've made this a stronger place for people to work and build careers.
Why AFSCME? I mean, how did that come about? How did you decide what union you were going to get, you were going to align yourself with, as opposed to being independent or what?
I actually was not part of that process myself, so I can't speak to it except in very broad terms. But, you know, AFSCME works with a number of other cultural institutions in our city, including the Free Library of Philadelphia. And they have launched the Cultural Workers United effort, which is unionizing a number of museums across this country now, including the Art Institute of Chicago, the Columbus Museum of Art, and others. So they have a strong understanding here of the work that happens in cultural institutions, and in that sense, it felt like a good fit.
So you guys set up the union 2 years ago or so, give or take, and it's been 2 years of negotiating about this contract. At what point did and its pay, job security, healthcare, all of the goodies, I guess, that are involved in this, sick leave and parental leave, is my understanding as well. How did you, and it's, you struck essentially 3 weeks out, 4 weeks out from the opening of the Matisse exhibit. So did, Matisse sort of gave you a hand here?
A little bit. I mean, we did have a warning strike. We did do a 1 day warning strike in mid September, which we hoped would, bring some better offers to the table, and also facilitate resolving our unfair labor practice charge in essentially meddling with union busting in negotiations. So we were hoping actually very much to avoid striking in the lead up to Matisse, because many of the people in our unit worked very hard on that show and wanted to see it through. Unfortunately, our 1 day strike did not have the impact that we had hoped for, and so we did end up on a longer strike in the lead up to a very large exhibition for the museum.
How rancorous were things over the past 3 weeks? I mean, was it this can go a lot of different ways. I'm curious. I think we all have a perception of museum administration to be genteel but how rancorous did this get?
I will say from the start that for almost everybody involved, this was their first strike action, both within our staff. Many of my colleagues have worked in the arts, and the arts are not known for being a unionized environment. So for many of us, this was new to us, and it was also very new to the administration of this institution. And so there was a lot of figuring things out on the ground that happened on both sides, I would say. I'm sure the museum's social media campaign it might have crossed someone's path that certainly seemed to have gotten a lot of attention on Twitter, which involved reminding people that the museum was open and staffing the museum with management and non-labor staff to kind of keep things hobbling along while we were outside. And that I think did not sit very well, not only with us, but with Philadelphia and museum audiences more broadly.
I read that they used, and this is my words, I mean, I don't have to work there, so I can say stuff like this, scabs to hang the Matisse exhibit. I mean, and I imagine this Matisse, you know, these are owned by other museums and maybe by some private collectors. I'd be a little nervous, frankly, if some Johnny come lately is hanging up my picture, my painting that's worth, I don't know. I mean, I'd be nervous if it was worth $2,500, but I imagine that some of these Matisse are a little more valuable.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, right? I mean, was there, I mean, how did that go? I mean, I would be nervous if you're bringing in non, like, you know, people who are sort of like, well, I did it once in college. I hung a picture, you know, that I'd be a little concerned about that.
So I can only speak to this from the perspective of someone who was outside, because I was not privy to these conversations. During the strike, we were all cut off from our email and access to museum servers and databases. So we were truly in the dark about what was happening inside. I will say, from the union side, there was, you know, our installers are incredibly skilled and experienced, and most of them have been with the museum for between 5 and 20 years. It was unfortunate to see a scenario, and that I think was avoidable, where they were outside and other people were inside doing their jobs.
Yeah, I think that I would imagine they were freaking out just from the perspective of being, you know, people who obviously have an emotional connection to this artwork. Unrelated question, glass in front of these pictures?
I haven't been in yet. This is my third day back at work, so okay. I'm just still slogging through
it's
my
just
inbox.
It's just in the news right now, Amanda. All right, so everyone's back. And how long is this contract for?
This contract is a 3-year contract.
That's great.
Retroactive to July 1.
Were there lessons? I mean, this is the first time you've ever been on strike. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I think like one of the things that's happening right now is that there are workers from, you know, museums and warehouses and from restaurants and coffee shops and teachers, I mean, across the board, Apple stores, where there's a lot of people, it seems to me, who are forming unions, joining a union, going on strike for the first time, contemplating it for the first time. One of the things that I noticed in reading up on your strike is that it seemed like, and maybe it's a little counterintuitive, but the longer it went on, the more sort of determined the strikers became, right? I mean, because, you know, it's almost like there was a second wind that took place somewhere around week 2 or something like that. Will you explain that dynamic, just both how it felt to be on strike, like the fears that you may have had, and then what surprised you about that experience?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest takeaway for me was that we could do it. And we could hold the line. Week 1 was tough. We had the remnants of a hurricane come through Philadelphia. It was very cold and very wet for a lot of week 1. But once we crested into week 2, and everyone who started on strike was still ready to keep pushing through, we really hit a stride where we were confident together that we could do this. We started to see the impact in, you know, snippets coming outside from inside about the work falling behind. You know, one manager came out and said, every week you're out here, we fall a month behind inside. I think we really started to be able to visualize the impact and the power of our labor. And I think that that really began to be a motivator for everybody. I don't think this was ever a money fight. I think this was a power fight. And once we hit a point, maybe a week and a half in, when we, you know, were scheduling people for the following week and no one was balking and everyone was signing up for extra shifts, it was a fight that we knew we could win. We just had to outlast them. And we did. You know, everything that we put on the table at the start of the strike, we won at the end of the strike.
What is the feeling at work now with your workers? I mean, obviously, everybody's psyched that they won the actual material concessions, and they've improved their work, their work situation. Is there another, like, sort of intangible element that, you know, you guys all did this together? And it's, I wonder if, as you're walking through the museum now, there's a slightly different feeling when you see somebody hanging a picture, or you see those folks, or, you know, the person taking tickets or working at the gift shop, or, you know, I don't know, sweeping the floor or whatever it is.
We certainly got to know each other a lot better during this process. You know, I think there is a bond that has been forged between staff across this institution. And what I hope is that translates not only into continuing to build a strong union, but also into our own work within the museum. So I think it's going to make us better collaborators. It'll help us really understand each other's roles within this institution better. And I ultimately think that's a great thing for this museum.
Lastly, have you heard from other museum staff, other museums, other cultural institutions, I don't know, in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania or across the country at all? Have anybody reached out yet to get some advice?
Yes. I won't say where, but yeah.
I understand. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's exciting. And I imagine you're certainly open to more of those type of calls.
Yeah. If anyone's thinking about unionizing their cultural institution, we are happy to talk. I think, you know, we've now gone from organizing into, I would say, a very difficult contract fight, and we came out on top. So y'all can do it. we're hoping to really be able to set a better tone and a better way of appreciating and valuing workers and cultural institutions through our strike and through our organizing.
Amanda Bach, Museum Curator and Shop Steward of the Philadelphia Museum of Art Union. Thanks so much for joining us. Folks can go down and check out the Matisse exhibit. Now also, helpful in getting all the museum workers back into work and in a much better working situation. Congratulations to you and your colleagues. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on. All right, folks. Now it's time for us to head to the fun half of the program. Not to imply that this half hasn't been fun. I found it fun. But it's the next half of the program is going to be
officially designated.
Officially designated. A lot more pressure to be more fun in the fun half. Glizzy McGuire, IM's former art handler here, hiring scabs was a dangerous move for the museum. It's not rocket science to hang a picture, sure, but it's pretty easy to F up and damage artwork. The know-how that professionals that were on strike have is valuable, especially when dealing with priceless works of art. Good on them for standing up for their rights and succeeding with their unionization efforts. I happen to know someone who is a technical art restorer, and their job is when, like, if you got a Matisse, for instance, that drops, or like, I mean, you'd think, you know, things happen and they rip. And if you, you know, what they'll do is this technical restorer will take swatches, has swatches of canvas. So if it's like Matisse, maybe he's got one from like 1905 or 1909 or, you know, somewhere around there, where, that he knows, well, first of all, that is from that era, but also knows the technology that Matisse himself would have used to fix it, and uses that and then basically makes it appear as if it had been repaired at that time to save the value of this thing. So it happens. It definitely happens.
I feel bad, but I don't know who Matisse. I know Matisse Thibault.
You don't know who Henri Matisse is?
No.
I went to
his serious?
I went to his cutouts exhibit at the Met or the MoMA a few years ago. That was pretty cool.
Let me do an image search.
You'll recognize him. Matisse is one of the biggest. I mean, not one. I mean, he's one of the.
That's cool stuff. He's a good one.
Yeah. Was he part of the Fauvis? I can't remember. I don't remember. But all right. Well, we'll do a little bit more art history
seems like
in the office.
Yeah. Fauvis.
A little bit. Yeah. All right. Bingo Dango has a good point too. Those Matisse paintings were surely in much more danger than the Van Gogh sunflower painting over to that protest. Where's the outrage from all these newly minted art lovers?
That's a good point.
Very good point. Very good point. Judy Rigliani says Matisse was sick in the good way. We will deal with all of this in the fun half. This is what I'm talking about. Yeah, the fun half. You have like the art half. Just a reminder, folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you do four things. One, you allow the show to survive and thrive. That's two. You get the free half free of commercials. That's three. You get the fun half. That's four. Actually, five. You actually support other members who might be going through some financial stress. You support their becoming members. I said the fun half. So there's five things. How many things can you do by doing one thing? You do five things. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out ESVN from Monday. They go over all the games and basketball season's live. I heard Matt Leck, did you make an appearance on that show?
No, Waz did. I'm going to be talking about basketball
soon.
Yes,
but we had a Minnesota caller who was, you know, giving us some Timberwolves previews, so we definitely needed Matt. We need Matt to come on.
The Celtics look sweet.
Yeah, good game last night.
Oh, my God. I think Saul and I might have to get on it. You know what I did? I went and I bought Celtics Nets tickets for December.
Right after that. That'd be a good game.
Yep. Yeah, that's going to be tough.
I think.
Very.
Sure. And so I may take Saul to his first basketball game.
Yeah, that'll
December.
Be fun.
Yep. Matt, speaking of Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Oh, yeah. Last night, Harvey J.K., we talked about the British Marxist historians for a long time, and we also talked about different, like, LaRouche protest stuff and that sort of thing. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to the post game, and go check it out on YouTube.
Don't you, like, aren't alarm bells set off when you have people who describe themselves as LaRoucheites? The guy's dead.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that like, I mean, try and think of like what other.
Well, it's a cult.
What other, like, I mean.
Scientology.
Scientology.
Hubbard's dead.
You know who else is dead? And supposedly going to come back. That Jesus Christ guy. And they named the whole like thing after him.
Yeah. Yeah, we watched a little bit in the post game of the eclipse from the LaRouche sort of conference, the Green Fascism conference.
Yes, I saw some of those clips.
Jackson Hinkle and the other guy, like, you know, saying dumb shit, and then the LaRouche cult is being like, we need to exonerate LaRouche. It's like, LaRouche is dead. Like, what are you talking about?
It is weird. Really weird stuff going on there.
It's you see, like, I was watching the Nexium documentary on that cult. And I just say the way that they say you're operating in fear right now, this how you're, you know, questioning the tenets of the cult is Jimmy Dore. Like the like that's what that stuff is.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
You bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.